asking the right questions can greatly impact your future, especially when it comes to your finances.
So if you're looking for a financial advisor you can trust, certified financial planner professionals are committed to acting in your best interest. That's why it's got to be a CFP. Find your CFP professional at letsmakeaplan.org.
In recent weeks, we've really focused on some ways that listeners can boost their income. So whether that's through starting your own side business and growing your network like Hala talked about, or when we talked with local realtor Alan about diving into investing in real estate, well, what better way to test the waters? While you are away, your home could also earn extra income.
That's right. Your empty space could be an Airbnb while you're traveling, because that's all you need to become an Airbnb host. It's a lot easier than you think, and you don't need to Airbnb your entire house. You could just host your extra spare room. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
It's brand new season two. I'm Marissa Thalberg.
And I'm Stephen Wolf Bedatum. And we're excited to be back having bigger, bolder, and always real conversations.
Straight from the C-suite front lines of marketing, media, and more.
We have great friends joining from people you may know, like Vilmer Valderrama and Bobby Burke.
And people you'll want to know. So grab a coffee or, hey, even an Aperol Spritz and come join us on America's number one podcast network, iHeart.
Listen to Brand New on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to How to Money. I'm Joel.
I'm Matt.
Today, we're talking budgeting like a beast with Jesse Meekum.
That's right, Jesse Meekum. He is joining us on the podcast today, and we are going all in on budgeting. I'm guessing there's a number of folks listening who might recognize his name, but I'm guessing even more folks are familiar with the company he started back in 2003 while he was still in college, You Need a Budget, or YNAB, as it's commonly known, what we call it. Millions of individuals have now used YNAB to get on a budget, which has allowed them to achieve their life-changing financial goals. And so whether that's simply paying off debt or the complicated endeavor of getting on the same page as your partner, that's difficult. Jesse has likely thought more about budgeting over the past 20 years than anyone else out there, so we're excited to talk with him about all the things that he's learned and observed. Jesse, thank you for joining us today.
I am so glad to be here. Thanks, guys.
Jesse, we're glad to have you. And the first question we ask everyone who comes on the show is, what do you like to splurge on? We call it your craft beer equivalent because Matt and I, we spend more money than most people would think is normal on craft beer because we love it. But we're happy to do that because we're saving and investing well for the future while we're spending a lot of money on beer. So what do you spend a lot of money on that maybe people might think is kind of crazy?
Yeah, I wouldn't mix beer and what I spend a lot of money on, but I would say my wood shop.
Oh.
It is a money pit. And there's always another thing you can buy. I'm currently in the shop for a floor or in the market for a floor standing variable speed drill press. Yeah.
So what are you making in this wood shop? Are you making like canoes, Ron Swanson style? What are you doing?
If I had the skills of Ron Swanson, I would have arrived. But he's in real life. He is a killer woodworker.
That's yes. Like, yeah, yeah. Yeah. I mean, like making beautiful handcrafted canoes.
Yeah, it's insane. So yeah. Anyway, I have his book here actually called Good Clean Fun by Nick Offerman. It's excellent. But I will make anything. But right now I'm working on shop furniture. Like because you can kind of learn. If it looks bad, it doesn't matter because it's all in your shop. So I'm learning a lot of the basics. I'm taking like a general like basic woodworking course where they go through all the different joinery, kind of the foundational joinery. And I love just being a novice. So I have a shop that looks like I'm a professional and I am a novice. And I'm not ashamed to admit it. I think it's fun to get the new tools. So whenever I can squeeze it into the old plan, I do it.
Very nice. So are you pursuing this purely out of just with it being a passion an interest, not something that you foresee being able to sell,
I would have ruined it. I don't want to ruin my hobby by monetizing.
He's going to open up like a Woodside stand, and people are going to be like, "I'm not paying for that chair."
It's wobbles. Jesse might get so good that folks are saying, "Please let me buy that."
Maybe
that beautiful.
I will gift it to them. But I refuse to transact in this hobby. I don't want to taint it.
Don't ruin it, Jesse. Yeah. I love it. Well, let's kind of start talking about money, not just the wood. So unlike most folks, it sounds like your parents actually had like a positive influence on you when it comes to getting you started down the path of personal finance. How is it that you first started learning about money?
So my parents modeled it well. They modeled frugality well, I will say. They were really good at just saying, we don't have money for that. We're not going to spend money on it. We were middle class, but we lived below our means as far as I could gather as a kid and kind of observe. So they were just very, very frugal. I used to think that the word vacation meant driving 10 hours to grandma's house. I didn't know that there were other options besides just driving up there. And then literally one time starting to read the encyclopedia at A, I got to Abacus. I didn't make it very far, but like I just bored on my vacation. So that's just what we did. And I didn't know any different and it was great. And they were loving. And so you can't complain at all. But one thing that my dad in particular did is I think I was 14 and he said, hey, you should read these books. And so he didn't just say, I want to teach you about money. He was just like, you might find these interesting. And he gave me a couple. He gave me Ramsey's book that was Financial Peace. And I think now the Total Money Makeover is kind of his more flagship book. But Financial Peace was the one that I read. And Ramsey taught me not to like debt at all, to hate debt even as a 14-year-old. And I thought, okay, that sounds good. And then he gave me The Millionaire Next Door, another great one to kind of learn. Like it's not about what you see, but it's about what's kind of under the covers a lot of the time. Mm-hmm. And then the final one was The Richest Man in Babylon, which is probably my favorite overall, just those principles, approachable. It's the same first one I would give, I give my kids when they are like, hey, I want to learn something. I don't want to sit down and teach them. I just want to say, well, here's a book. And I think as a kid, it's easier to learn sometimes from someone else. And so I think it was wise of my dad just to say, well, hey, learn it from these, from these books. And it formed a lot of my early opinions. Some of them have developed over the years a little differently, but it was early and formative, and I am forever grateful that I had a disdain for debt early on and avoided it in college because of that.
Yeah.
And that I saw early on that I should start with investing and get like an early jump on it. So I will be forever grateful to the authors of those books and to my dad for giving them to me.
Well, you talk about modeling, your parents modeling the right behaviors, but then not being the ones to necessarily preach it at you, over and over. And I think that's really important because I think modeling goes the farthest, then let someone else do the preaching. And maybe that's the best combo. And it's interesting, you mentioned your kids too. You've got 7 kids, which is as much as Matt and I have combined. Matt's got 4, I've got 3.
Our kids
we got to catch up.
I mean, you need a spreadsheet to run that many kids. Basically.
Right, right.
So you guys would be fine. But
it's easier for us. I've got family 5, he's got family 6, but you got a massive family. So how has that impacted your, did that like make you feel like you needed a budget? Obviously, you started your journey even before that, but have you found it to come in even more handy having big of a family?
Well, honestly, the thing that made me, and my wife's name is Julie, that made us feel like we had to really be careful early on was we were dirt poor and we were both in school and just eking by, and then we were going to get married. And so combining these meager finances together, it doesn't do any, there's no synergy there. You're just like, okay, now we both make, there was just no win. And we were actually paying more in rent than we would have been as single kids. Anyway, so I'm just like, man, Julie, we got to be really careful. So we get married. I build this little spreadsheet that later became YNAB. But at the time, it was just for me and for Julie. And we start watching everything really close. But the thing that pushed me to say, hey, maybe I could sell this spreadsheet was it had worked for us for that year. We were able to start saving money. And then we saw that a baby was coming. It was planned, but we were still not making a lot of money, like 10 bucks, 11 bucks an hour, and trying to get through school. And so to have a baby inbound, that was what made us think, okay, we got to try and figure out some way to let Julie exit the workforce and have me be able to try and balance maybe earning some side money and finishing up school. So the push of of providing for kids, oh, that was what gave us that that drive. And so I'm grateful for it. It's not fun in the moment, but it does kind of squeeze the creativity out of you at times.
Yeah. So, it's a kick in the pants.
Nothing like another human being dependent on your ability to manage your own finances in order to provide for them.
Yeah.
So that certainly can be, that, like you said, Joel, a kick in the pants. But like, what would you say, Jesse, to folks who are otherwise then just repulsed by the idea of making a budget? Essentially, I would love for you to maybe make a case for budgets for those out there who don't necessarily feel like it's something they need to do.
Yeah, I mean, I don't even like the word budget. I wish that our company was named something really, fancy. Like, it sounds like a perfume, maybe. I don't know. Something different. Because people, they hear the word budget and they think restriction, no more fun, diet. Mm-hmm. It's just, it everything's just going to kind of bear down on them. And maybe their spouse or significant other tells them, hey, we need a budget. And then it's like double worse. It's like, okay, not only will it be a budget, but you're going to be running the budget and I'm going to be the one that's making all the mistakes, and just nothing is good about it. So a budget is really, it's just a plan. And all we really care about is that people are intentional with their money. Mm-hmm. And that's it. That's the end of it. We want people to love how they spend their money instead of having their spending just stress them out, strain their relationship, suck the fun out of everything. I mean, people are so worried about a budget taking the fun out of life, but they will go on vacation with this like this low burn, like kind of simmer in the back of their mind as they're racking up credit card debt. They're just like, I know this isn't good. And so I'm trying to say, well, maybe try the thing where you save up for the vacation and you actually get to spend money guilt-free. So a budget's just a plan, and it's your plan, and you get to make it however you want. But if it means that if you have to do a budget in order to have a pile of intention kind of like rising up behind your money, then that's what we want, and that's what we're going to call it. You got to love how you spend your money. If you feel guilty about it, there's a problem, right? If you're arguing with your spouse, it means there's a problem. And so we want to get that spending lined up with your real priorities. And then, man, you're off to the races. That's when money becomes fun. And I don't know. I can't imagine it any other way.
So did we just rename You Need a Budget to You Need a Money Plan, YNAMP?
Something like that. Or the clone thing. I could just Mystique or something. I don't know.
Okay. All right. Well, yeah, you let me know when you're ready for that rebrand. I'm curious to hear how it shakes
Joel's
out.
Joel was a fan of Cool Water, I think, when he was in middle school. So.
Drakkar Noir, maybe? That was a good one. Well, Jesse, some folks in the financial independence community, they're just super naturally frugal, right? And so they would say, I am intentional with my money, but I don't feel like I need the budget part. And so based on what you just said, what would you say to someone like that who says, like, I'm handling things pretty well. I've got a huge gap between incoming and outgoing. Mm-hmm. I'm investing a lot for the future. Like, do I need to sit down and actually like mess with the numbers every single month or every other week?
Yeah, no, they don't. If you have some massive gap between money in and money out, and the net worth keeps climbing, even if the market's doing what it's been doing, especially, then you're good to go. You have a plan, and the plan is working because the score that we're keeping is net worth. And especially, I would say the score is how much you are sending to your investment pile. Not so much fluctuations in the market. You can't totally control that. But the fact that you're you got a big shovel and you're flinging tons of money over the wall into that retirement bucket, you're winning. So I wouldn't change a thing. Now, for someone that's like, hey, Jesse, my net worth, it's, I'm not really saving a ton, but I know that I'm frugal, then I'd be like, no. Or they say, or they like, I already know how much. Yeah, they're like, I already know how much I spend. I'm like, no. Or I know that I eke by anyway, so I already am tight. I don't need to look. That's all just ways of saying, like, I don't really want to be aware, or I'm actually unaware, or I think I'm aware and I'm not. All those things we want to make sure we iron out. So, but for the person that like literally their money just keeps growing and growing, you hit it. You're doing it. You aren't super granular in your plan for your spending, but you're nailing it on those big movers, those big goals. Then you're good to go. I wouldn't have you change a thing.
I don't want to say those people are unicorns, but they're not as
it's just I'm not worried my market's going to disappear by just you
know? Yeah, that's maybe 1% of the population that really sure. is in that realm of managing their finances. But yeah. I do think it's important to mention that some of those folks exist and they might not need a budget in the same way that most
now,
people do.
If I could interject one more thing, someone that's, Elon, Bezos, these massively wealthy people, they still hopefully, with all of those resources, hopefully are being extremely intentional with all of that value that's there. Mm-hmm. So when you have someone that's like, I make tons, Jesse, I don't have to worry about it, I would kind of turn around and say, listen, man, you have been gifted this, you've worked for it, however you want to say this came into your possession, you have something tremendously valuable in this world. Let's not be so cavalier and so flippant about the fact that you have this massively useful resources that could potentially be deployed to have some great effect in the world. And I'm not even meaning, hey, shame on you for not giving it away. There are plenty of charities that I'd be like, oh, that probably wasn't a great use of money. If I'm no judge of that, but just let's take you and make sure that all of your intention, all of the best parts of you are channeled behind that big pile of money and that it becomes something great and grand. Let's not have it just be frittered away. So for those that have a fantastic pile of resources, I think it's incumbent upon them even more so to be really intentional, really thoughtful, careful about what they do with it.
Yeah, maybe that looks like a budget, but like you said, it's having a plan, and I think even those folks would be able to benefit from a plan, because you take a high performer and you put them under the direction of an amazing coach, and all of a sudden they're doing stuff that they never thought was possible, right? If making millions came easy to them, well, just think what you could do otherwise. But I like what you said too, like from an investing standpoint, they're kind of knocking it out of the park. But I mean, one of the reasons Kate and I, that we were able to get on the same page just when it came to budgeting, is because we saw it as a way for us to have some freedom in how it is that we spend our money. Because my natural tendency might be to not just be frugal, but just to seriously deprive ourselves. And so
like
what
miserly.
We saw, exactly. Mm-hmm. We saw an ability for us to, like you said, be intentional with our money, but just we had the freedom to then spend our money in the ways that we said we wanted to, but maybe in practice we found that to be harder.
Yeah,
moving
absolutely.
It from like the head and what we said we're going to do on paper into reality for us was difficult.
Yeah, absolutely. It's liberating to have the plan allow you to do things. It's weird because you set up the plan, you agreed to it, you wrote it down a week before or whatever. It's weird that we suddenly divorce ourselves from the plan as if it's not us, but it is. But it allows us to kind of push, like defer back to it and say, well, what did the plan say I could do? Oh, the plan said I could buy these fantastically expensive boots that will last forever. And I say that because it's a real example that I'm in the market for. So splurge again. But I it's like, oh, okay, this would be really cool. I'm really excited about this. But push came to shove. If the plan weren't telling me that I actually could do it, I think I would struggle with it because I'm just naturally wired to squeeze those dollars. Yeah. So I love that it gives you the permission. Like you give yourself the permission, but in this indirect way that allows it to feel a little more free-flowing.
Yep. Again, I don't know what percentage of the population those natural, ridiculously frugal people are. I think Matt and I might both be those. And actually making a plan for our money has helped us feel free to spend in the ways that we otherwise would probably not do. And
love
it's
that.
Really, it's helped my marriage out because then I'm not like saying no to everything, even though those are things we want to do. But I guess, Jesse, I want to know more too about YNAB. And you talked about kind of how it started with a spreadsheet that you created just to be able to get by making very, very little money and to help your wife stay at home. But how did it turn into a fintech company and a wildly successful one? I mean, I saw at the end of last year, the Wall Street Journal said YNAB was the best budgeting app. Like, that's huge. That's
awesome.
Massive. Yeah. So how did it get to that point?
Almost 20 years in, you get the Wall Street Journal to write about it. You know what I mean? So
couldn't you have done that a decade ago, guys?
Yeah, like that would have helped a lot. But I've always loved the topic. I've always loved teaching people about it. And I am a teacher at heart. And so we've always had the model. Now, the software, the spreadsheet's been long gone as of like, I think, 06 or something. But then we had some really, some great software that you would download and install and paste a license key for people that grew up without apps and whatnot. But then the apps came along and now the web app. And so it just keeps, the software keeps kind of hopefully keeping pace with what technology is allowing us to do. But the method behind it, it has always been kind of like the special juice, the thing that makes it work. Mm-hmm. So we always say that the software is second fiddle to the method, to the thinking. And if someone can take what we teach method-wise, these four rules, and that I'm sure we'll get into later, but if they can take that and run with it, no matter how they implement it, it'll work really, really well because the method works very, very well.
Even though the technology has changed, there are four rules in particular that you wrote down a long time ago. So we're going to talk about those rules. We're going to talk about
chiseled them in stone tablets, actually.
Yeah. We're going to talk about maybe some just some general budgeting strategy as well. We'll get to all of that right after this break.
Asking the right questions can greatly impact your future, especially when it comes to your finances. So, if you're looking for a financial advisor you can trust, certified financial planner professionals are committed to acting in your best interest. They are committed to high ethical standards and even had to pass a rigorous exam before they could become a CFP professional.
They offer financial planning and services that take a more comprehensive view of your financial and personal circumstances and are customized for your needs. Certified financial planner professionals can offer advice on a wide range of issues like reviewing your investment portfolio's allocation, handling an inheritance, rolling over a company retirement plan, building education savings, and so much more.
That's why it's got to be a CFP. Find your CFP professional at letsmakeaplan.org. And now a word from the show sponsors at Betterment. Do you want your money to dream big? Do you want your money to be a total self-starter? Are you annoyed that your money doesn't work hard enough? Don't worry, Betterment is here to help.
Betterment is the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Their automated technology is built to help maximize returns, meaning when you invest with Betterment, your money can auto-adjust as you get closer to your goal. Rebalance if your portfolio gets too far out of line and your dividends are automatically reinvested. That can increase the potential for compound returns. In other words, your money is breaking a sweat while you can be breaking bread. You'll never picture your money the same way again.
Betterment, the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Visit Betterment.com to get started. Investing involves risk. Performance is not guaranteed. Spring cleaning is kind of an annual rite of passage. We've all got to do it, minimize the junk that we have in our house. Emily and I, we just cleaned our closets out. It took hours, but it was so worth it. Now we've only got stuff in there that we love, and it's easier to find everything too. And so, you know, while cleaning your closets is helpful, well, there's something else you can do for your family this spring. Shopping for life insurance with Policy Genius, for example, is a really important part of your financial planning for the year.
That's right. Yeah. And here is the thing that's important to remember, because you might be thinking you don't need to check out Policy Genius because you've got a policy through work. But even if you have a life insurance policy through your job, it may not offer you enough protection for your family's needs, and it may not follow you if you leave your job. With Policy Genius, you can find life insurance policies that start at just $292 per year for $1 million of coverage. Some options offer same-day approval and avoid unnecessary medical exams. Policy Genius works for you, not the insurance companies, and that means they don't have an incentive to recommend one insurer over another, so you can trust their guidance.
Save time and money and provide your family with a financial safety net using Policy Genius. Head to PolicyGenius.com to get your free life insurance quotes and see how much you could save. That's PolicyGenius.com. All right, let's keep rolling. Let's talk about budgeting like a beast. We're still talking with Jesse Meekum. And if there's, Matt, anybody to cover this topic well with us, it is Jesse.
It's the guy that's a woodworker who's saving up for some nice leather boots to wear in his wood shop.
Exactly. You don't want to puncture those toes if like some mistake happens or anything like that. But Jesse, you talked about the four rules. You alluded to them before the break, but that's where everything starts when it comes to the YNAB software. Can you give us an overview of those four rules and why you think that that's kind of the revolutionary, like Matt said, secret sauce to making budgeting work for people?
Yeah. So, I mean, I had mentioned earlier that we want people to love how they spend their money, and spending is just decision-making at the end of the day. And people try and dress it up and make it some other thing that money is different, but it is just decisions. And the method that YNAB teaches is four rules that's essentially just to help you make better decisions. So our first rule, we call it giving every dollar a job. And what that means is if you decide to spend money on tool A, you can't spend money on tool B. If you decide to go out for sushi, you maybe can't also go out for drinks another day. It's that if I spend here, I maybe can't spend over there. And it's acknowledging that we have finite resources. And while finance, capital F, large industry, wants you to feel like you have infinite resources and you can spend and swipe and buy now, pay later and all that stuff, they want you to feel like you never run out. But you have to acknowledge that you run out, because that helps you crystallize what your priorities are and start to make better decisions. So when you operate with a zero-based budget, whether it's with YNAB or any number of other tools that do that, it's that idea of it's finite. So with that in place, you're now weighing your priorities, and good decisions come from that. We then move to rule two, where we call it embracing your true expenses. And essentially, that's looking ahead and thinking about larger, less frequent expenses, and then dividing those up into more manageable monthly amounts. So I mentioned sushi. It's kind of like me saying, all right, I want to go to sushi today, but also I'm looking at Christmas that just happened, and I'm saying, oh, well, Christmas is in 12 months or whatever. Is this going to work? Is Christmas and sushi today going to work? And people don't do that kind of calculus. Or it's a lot like if you're standing in the tire store or something, and your tire just blew, and the guy's there, and he's like, okay, the four tires are going to be, let's pray that they're only like $800, right? The four tires are going to be $800, and you have the money for the four tires. So you're like, man, I'm feeling good. But it's like a pizza delivery guy walks in too, and he's just like, Jesse, I know those tires are $800, and you have the $800, but don't you want to spend $100 on pizza for your kids and their friends? And maybe their friends, and just have some. And you're like, no, I absolutely do not want to do that. Not because of all the kids in the house, but because I want to pay for the tires. And so it's this interesting situation where with rule one, we're prioritizing. And with rule two, we're prioritizing with future priorities and current priorities. And they're getting equal footing during our decision-making process. So Faye, my youngest daughter, I have to refer to my spreadsheet to make sure I get that straight. But Faye, Faye, my youngest daughter, she's like, okay, I want to save up for this Christmas gift for Faye, and I also want to buy this thing right now. And suddenly you have a really interesting prioritization that's happening. Now, do I sit there? I'm always like, oh, am I going to take a gift from Faye's Christmas? No, of course not. But as you're doing the decisions, you are. And so this idea of future you and current you, and then future Julie and current Julie, we're all sitting at the table together negotiating. And there's one that's like, I want money for tires. Another one's like, I want pizza tonight. And we're weighing that. So between rule one and rule two, decision-making starts to really improve. I'll pause there just in case you guys have questions. But I'm like an automaton. If you put a quarter in me or ask me about the four rules, I just kind of go. So
Let's go ahead and jump in here before you move on with the additional rules, because when you talk about giving every dollar a job, like, it makes me think about just budgeting in general, right? Yeah. Like if we asked you to define the word budget, I'm curious to hear what you would say, because you did say a plan earlier, but it seems like at the heart of budgeting is the first rule, giving every dollar a job, where you are just being intentional when it comes to, like you said, the decisions that you're making. Does that seem accurate?
Yeah, I think I would say if I were to define, I've never done this before, perhaps, but if I were to define it off the cuff, a budget is a plan attached to finite resources. That's it.
Given a specific time frame as well, when it comes to embracing those true expenses, because I think a big part of those true expenses is the fact that I think there's so much in our life that feels urgent, that seems urgent. And so oftentimes we're just looking to whatever pops up in front of us, and we think, oh, okay, that is now something I have to tackle. That's something we have to spend money on. And it's just about, it's almost about getting in front of that a little bit and knowing that it's on its way, as opposed to you just reacting to something passively. It's proactively managing those expectations and knowing they're going to come down the pike.
Yeah, absolutely. It is completely and totally proactive. If you manage your day the way you manage your money, I'm speaking to the 80% that don't do it well, you'd be a wreck. You're a train wreck. You're just reacting to everything that comes along. And at the end of the day, you're always like, well, geez, I didn't get the important thing done. That happens with people's money all the time. They're just like, we manage time. We're just trying to manage another finite resource that also can essentially travel through time. And we're looking at how our future will look, how our, the current environment looks, and we're trying to weigh that together. It's it's interesting to do it this way, because what we want people to get in their kind of in practice is not that budgeting is where you're forecasting your income. You're saying, I will earn this, I will earn this. We tie it back to the finiteness of their money. And we say, how much is in your checking account right now? Okay, what do you want that money to do before you're paid again? And that question, whether you're making 100 grand a year, 300 grand, 50 grand, doesn't matter. That question starts to push on the priorities and starts to force the decisions. So then you can say, well, okay, I've got all these current needs, but then we get future you to come to the table also. It's like, well, you know, what about in 3 months when you wanted to go on vacation? You know, do you want to throw some money there? So it's more about allocating, not just for now, but also almost like you're allocating to these different jobs along a timeline. And in that way, you can be really ready for the future. It's funny too, because people mention when they've started using YNAB for, they've used it for a while, they stop needing the traditional kind of personal finance emergency fund because they're finding that they are having fewer emergencies. Because the car tires that wear out, that is an emergency only if you don't have the money. But if you do have the money, it's no emergency at all. Or if the HVAC goes out or property taxes are due, it's whenever we have the money, we never label it an emergency. We're just like, well, now if physical harm is, you know, if there's a fire, okay, yeah, that is an emergency, physical harm. But when the financial ramification can be handled by cash on hand, we're pretty reticent to say like, oh yeah, that was an emergency. Oh, no, it really wasn't. You know,
that's true.
You had the money.
Yeah. And we're planning ahead for some of those known irregular expenses too, like car tires, right? That's, yeah. I don't know, every 50, 60,000 miles, you're going to need new tires. And so that's something you can kind of start to plan ahead for, or a new roof. You know, the timeline of a roof is 25 years, but you can see if your roof is starting to get decrepit. Yeah. It's not typically this massive unknown. I needed a full roof replacement and I had no idea it was coming. And some of those things that we like to categorize as an emergency, but it's usually just a lack of preparation, a lack of planning. Yeah. And okay, but I want to know too, like one of the things that we get questions on a lot and we try to answer the best we can is for folks who are paid irregularly, right? Yeah. Folks who work for themselves, they run their own business, or they're a contractor. Like, how should they think about budgeting when they're not sure how much money's coming in month to month? Whereas the person who gets paid every 2 weeks, it's so much easier to know exactly how much you're going to have on hand.
Yeah. So never, ever, ever budget with money that you don't have on hand. Never forecast. Now, if you want to dream and kind of plan big, and start to say like, oh, what would it be like if I landed these three other clients and I sold these three houses or whatever? Yeah, you want to do that kind of big picture planning and dreaming. That's cool. But when it comes to decision making about your spending, you only ever talk about money that is in the account, not that you're going to get, that is there already. So for a variable income person, there's that rule is number one. Do not plan with money that you do not have in hand. That's the first. The second rule is, because your income is variable, you have to build more buffer. And that's kind of jumping to rule four, but you have to essentially build more runway for yourself, just more breathing room to allow yourself to roll with the fact that it's not, you know, that it is irregular. Mm-hmm. I've been down that road for years, you know, years and years where we had a very variable income. And it just is what it is. So only ever plan with money you have and build more buffer than your friend that's paid every 2 weeks by the city, you know. And that's just your reality. But once you do that and you start looking to the future with rule two, and when there are flush months, because variable income, a lot of times people are like, oh, variable income is tricky because when I don't have any money, I have a problem. They never mention how they had a lot of money 2 weeks ago, you know? Yeah. And so it is just up and down, up and down. And so when you are flush, when you are like, oh my gosh, honey, we are rich, your first thought is, let's celebrate. We landed the big deal. Let's celebrate. And yet, cool, do celebrate. But also recognize there are going to be some lean times and do a little bit of like Joseph in Egypt, where it's like 7 years feast and famine, and start to look ahead and say, well, you know what? I'm going to fund half of our mortgage for a month from now. And then 3 months later, you're like, I'm going to fund the rest of our mortgage for next month. And I might fund half of our mortgage for 2 months out. And we'll get people that are running YNAB that are on extremely variable incomes that have funded their kind of their core, you know, must-have fixed expenses, they've funded them 3, 4, 5 months out because they know that there can be some lean times. But and I'll just add one little thing, just a pitch for this. When you are operating on a variable income and you've eliminated the variability in your stress level tied to it, life-changing.
Isn't that the biggest reason to make this plan? Like, is there anything better? We want people to get their money together. We want them to be confident in how they handle their money. But the biggest problem when you're not confident with how you handle your money and you are living paycheck to paycheck is the stress, the rain cloud of stress that hangs over you every single day, and it's weighing you down.
Yeah, and it makes your decision-making in your business and elsewhere, it really has a negative effect on it. You start to be really... you react really quickly. You take clients that you actually don't want. You don't stop jobs that you hate that are low profit because you're just taking anything you can. And we want you to be choosy. We want you to be really selective. We want you to be making the best decision for you and your whole life. And all of that starts to kind of be hurt when we're just so stressed out and so reactive. So those two rules fix variable income.
You kind of alluded to this, but we'll give you a chance to get back to rules 3 and 4, but we kind of touched on how that variable income, having more cash in hand, that's rule 4 of the four rules, right? Like you're talking about aging your money. You're talking about, like you said, only spending money that you have on hand. And in some ways, like when it comes to that variable income, you're kind of like pushing that money off into the future.
Yes. Yeah.
You absolutely. Know, it's money that you're earmarking for future purchases, like you said, must have things like a mortgage, paying for food. So we kind of covered 4. What's the third rule that you think is important for folks to keep in mind in order to have a successful budget?
Yeah. And remember, we're talking about really good decision making. Like, it's just a decision making framework to make sure that spending lines up with priorities. And that's where the magic happens. So if we're giving every dollar a job and we're also looking ahead to future dollars and we're giving those jobs and we're weighing our priorities, the third rule, it's interesting that we have to have it be a rule, but we call it rolling with the punches. And it's essentially saying, be flexible. Change your mind if you need to. As new information comes in, change the plan. You had alluded to like a coach that can really capitalize on someone with a lot of great raw talent. And there's also the coach that has a really solid game plan. And then as soon as the ball is hiked or the tip off happens or whatever it is, as soon as that happens, the coach is making adjustments. And you're seeing how your opponent is reacting to your plan and you're reacting to that plan. And it's this big game of chess, which is another great example of reacting and acting. And so we want the plan that you've set in place, this budget, we want you to be flexible. Rigid budgets break and flexible budgets last a long, long time. Too many people, first of all, they've never budgeted before. And so they think that they're just going to suddenly be this like wunderkind that's going to be like, I got this nailed. And you don't. So you want to give yourself lots of grace. And when we talk about being flexible, give yourself the flexibility to say like, I thought I wanted to do this with my money, but then my friend called me and they said, hey, should I, you know, do you want to come out to eat? And you're like, yes, I do. So reallocate some money, shift things around, change your priorities a little bit. You're good to go. You know, it's like you're planning a beach day and then it starts to rain and you think vacations don't work. You know, we don't like, no, it's just that it's raining. So you just make some adjustments and keep rolling. Yeah.
Okay. So quick follow up here. Would you recommend for folks to revisit their budget every single month and make small tweaks? Is this a quarterly thing? I say this because I recently, my wife and I had our big end of the year sort of meeting where we
budget
look back
summit.
At our, yeah, yeah. We look back at the past year when we make some of these larger changes, but yeah, I'd be curious to hear your thoughts on making these adjustments, how often they should be and to what extent.
So depending on how much progress you are trying to make and how much room you have between how much you spend and how much you make. So if you have a lot of room in there, then you don't need to be quite as engaged. You don't need to be. It still may serve you well. But as people are really trying to transform their finances, maybe they're trying to get out of debt, they're trying to reach some financial goals, they're maybe not in the same spot you all are or your listeners are, they need to be actively in their budget. I mean, a lot of people like to at least weekly sit down and say, okay, where are we at? But when someone is first starting, just be in the budget every day. Replace Instagram with scrolling through your categories and being like, this looks good, this looks good. And when you're about to spend money, you want to look at the app and say, well, can I spend the money here? And if you can, spend it joyfully, no guilt, record it, or the bank, maybe it'll send you the transaction. We hook up with the bank or whatever. But at the end of the day, you want to be actively always kind of reallocating based on how the spending is shaping up. As you get more wiggle room in the budget, this becomes less necessary. But if you are trying to make real meaningful progress with your finances, which means real behavior change, the more frequently you are in the app, kind of exercising a muscle that's been dormant for a long time, the better results you'll get.
Yeah, that makes sense. It's like the longer you've been doing anything, the better you get at it, the less intense you have to be about focusing on it. I want to ask you too, you just mentioned scrolling on Instagram, which is a problem for a lot of people when it comes to, that could be like a budget buster in their lives. Mm-hmm. The rise of buy now, pay later is something that we have talked about a lot on the show. We hate it.
Targeted ads. Yeah. I'm going to start getting ads for nice boots now.
Right, exactly.
They just heard us. Yeah, they heard us and they're like, get them, go get them
yes,
now.
Exactly. It's like, sick them, guys. Let's get them to spend some of their money on this stuff. So it feels like everything around us is conspiring, leading us towards making worse decisions, towards money outflowing. Do you feel like it's harder for folks to resist impulse spending these days? And do you feel like that's part of what's leading to like an inability for folks to budget and to come up with a good plan for themselves?
Yeah, it absolutely is. It's and I don't like framing it as like you're a victim of the man, the system is out to get you. At the end of the day, I have to side on the side of take responsibility, take action. You can control your situation. You can change, because anything else would be a disservice to a person that desires change, right?
There you go.
So you can change. You can do this. Now, conspiring, though, I love that word, because I mean, I'm a profit-seeking business owner just like everyone else. And all this financialization of everything is for profit. And you can say it's good or evil or whatever you want, but it just is. So knowing that they're kind of out to get you does help you maybe feel a little bit of motivation to be like, oh, no, you don't. And a little bit of like some gumption that might come along. So
totally. That
could be helpful. But you also want to make sure that when you do want to spend the money that you enjoy it. So I don't want people to associate spending as bad. It's not. It's just spending when it's out of alignment with what you really want. That's where we don't want to have all the misses.
Yeah. And again, that's where the craft beer equivalent for us, that's something we talk about all the time on the show. That is something we hammer home. Like, find the things that do move the needle for you, because there's a lot of deprivation mentality in the personal finance space, and we don't want to contribute to that.
Yeah.
Jesse, I'd love to hear your thoughts on lifestyle creep as well, because like as individuals make more money, like I think it's fine to use some of that to like give some folks more breathing room to spend, to maybe not have to revisit their budget quite as often. But it can also be a slippery slope, right? And so like, how do you want people to react, say, when they get a pay raise, when they see their income go up? How would you encourage folks, going back to a word that you've already said, prioritize how it is that they spend?
Yeah, I wish I had a better answer for this. It's no different. Like if you get double the money, all of a sudden you just got a sweet raise. I mean, awesome. High five. Like this is awesome, you know? So you just got to go back and say, okay, how much, you know, what does this money need to do before I'm paid again? And now you have more money. And so you think, well, what does this money need to do before I'm paid again? I don't like the phrase lifestyle creep. I used to use it all the time. It's one of those things I mentioned early on where it was like, oh, you know, you should just always be spending less. And lifestyle creep makes it sound like it snuck up on you. It just kind of, it sounds creepy and that seems negative. So I don't like anything about it. I think when people are talking about lifestyle creep, they're really talking about the slow, almost imperceptible misalignment of spending and priorities. And with that, I'm like, I'm on it. Like, yes, let's get rid of that. But if you're saying, hey, Jesse, you make, I don't know how much more than when Julie and I, when we first started YNAB, I mean, gosh, I don't even know, guys, 10, 20, 30 times more. I mean, it's in some insane amount. Are you saying that I still should be living in the same basement apartment that gave us respiratory issues the whole time? You know, and it's like, well, no, that's okay. But we just don't want lifestyle.
Where do you draw the line?
Yeah, it's like, where is that line drawn? Well, I'm not going to draw the line for your listeners or for you guys. It's up to everyone to, especially when you're sharing finances, you two hand in hand, you know, you grab the Sharpie. Actually, it's not a Sharpie. It's something erasable. And you draw the line together, and then you recognize that you're going to revisit it regularly. Every year, I promote the idea of a budget burn down, meaning you drop all assumptions. It's like, should we have health insurance? Should we not? You know, of course, get catastrophic health insurance. Should we rent or should we buy? Should we have five roommates or should we get rid of our five roommates? Should we get rid of all of our cars? I mean, just burn down every single assumption to kind of start fresh. And it's a way to make sure that this lifestyle creep or misalignment of priorities and spending hasn't happened to you. I mean, it will have happened. Like, it happens to all of us all the time.
Or so, even allows you to rethink what you truly love and what you truly want to spend money on, right? Yeah. Because we get used to doing things and we continue those things in perpetuity. And we might say, wait a second, the second car doesn't matter to us anymore, but the trip to Europe does. And
absolutely.
So I want to strip that out. And that's a big, massive change, but probably in reality, the same amount of money that you're going to spend in a year. So I think that's a really, really cool concept. Jesse, I want to hear your updated thoughts on debt, because you just talked about how you talked at the beginning about reading Dave Ramsey and how maybe that influenced your view of debt. But I wonder if that's changed. We'll get to a couple questions on that with Jesse Meekum right after this. Asking the right questions can greatly impact your future, especially when it comes to your finances. So, if you're looking for a financial advisor you can trust, certified financial planner professionals are committed to acting in your best interest. They are committed to high ethical standards and even had to pass a rigorous exam before they could become a CFP professional.
They offer financial planning and services that take a more comprehensive view of your financial and personal circumstances and are customized for your needs. Certified financial planner professionals can offer advice on a wide range of issues like reviewing your investment portfolio's allocation, handling an inheritance, rolling over a company retirement plan, building education savings, and so much more.
That's why it's got to be a CFP. Find your CFP professional at letsmakeaplan.org. I'm guessing that a lot of listeners are starting to solidify their summer travel plans. We always like to get the families together, Matt, for a week at the beach every single summer. We've already got that trip to St. Simons on the calendar. Pumped for that. But sometimes those vacations get expensive. So what better way to offset some of those costs than to have your home earning some money while you're away?
That's right. Why let it sit empty when it could be earning extra income? It's the financially smart thing to do. So think it through. Maybe you've got some extra space in your home, or maybe you have an entire house to host, or maybe you're just going on vacation and your home is sitting empty. In every case, you can Airbnb it. You already have the space, so it won't be a huge adjustment.
I mean, the way I see it, if you're not using your space, you have two options. You can let it just sit there empty, or you do some optimizing and make some money off it. Really, if you think about it, you already have an Airbnb. You just need to start using it. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
If you're listening to this podcast right now and you're a small business owner, listen up. Upswell Marketing would like to remind you that when customers choose your small business, they're actually choosing you. So focus on super serving your existing customers and let Upswell handle the pipeline generation of new leads and customers. They do everything from hyper-targeting best fit prospects through campaign optimization. Upswell Marketing's unique approach includes direct mail, search engine marketing, and social media ads, and has fueled more than 10,000 small business success stories. Upswell specializes in developing customized direct response campaigns and is now offering a no-obligation free assessment of your current marketing strategies. Not to mention, new customers also receive 15% off their first order when they mention that they heard about Upswell on this podcast. For more information, visit upswellmarketing.com. That's upswellmarketing.com.
All right, we are back. We are talking about just the different ways that you can budget, different strategies to take, whether or not you are using a specific software or not. And Jesse, just before the break, Joel brought up debt. Let's talk about that. I'm curious to hear your thoughts on credit cards specifically, right? Just because, I mean, you know, you're massively pro-budget. Does that mean you are anti-credit card? What is the what's the YNAB approach to credit cards?
Yeah, so I'll start with the YNAB approach first. We are agnostic as to the spending instrument you use. Now, that means that we've done our best in the software to create a system where a credit card acts like cash. Because we've talked a lot about finite resources, and a credit card lets you not acknowledge finite resources. And people can say all they want about, well, I do this and I always pay it off. But at the end of the day, you are spending money and it's not money you have. Now, you could say, oh, no, it's in the checking account, but the cash has not left your system yet. So you just straight up, That's how it is. Now, what we've done in YNAB is tried to make it act like cash, where if you spend on the credit card, let's say $100 for groceries, no cash left to your system, but we take $100 from your grocery category and we move it to your credit card payment category.
Nice.
So that when that, you know, when the credit card's due or whatever, it's on auto pay if you're doing it well, it just, the cash is there. So we've done our best to say, hey, this is like cash, treat it like cash. Now, if someone's coming off of a lot of credit card problems, I say just don't use them for a while. Like, hey, they bit you already. Like, let's not mess with those for a while. They are more complicated than just swiping with a card and having money go out.
The so psychological element, for
absolutely.
Sure.
The reconciliation is more complicated. The bank transactions come in and do weird things. Sometimes a refund will hit, and it hit 2 months before, and you'll see the refund go back, and so you'll be sitting there with your software like, what happened? It makes it more complicated. That's bit me in the past. So I say that all to be like, we're trying to get the credit card to not be a credit card in our system, which is funny, which just tells you how negative they really are, because we're trying to, well, I don't know, whatever the opposite of negate is, this negative thing. And that's just, it's telling. My personal experiment this year, and this is early days, but I didn't cut our credit card or whatever. I threw it in a drawer, but I moved all of our spending off of what was basically our primary spending card for Julie and I, and we are using our debit cards. My theory, and I don't care about the rewards or the points. Like, there's one way to tell, this is a little bit of a diversion. There's one way to tell if banks like the rewards or don't like the rewards. And it's that they keep pushing the rewards. So
it's that the fact that they exist.
They exist. They exist, and that banks are wildly profitable institutions.
Yeah.
So you can say, oh, Jesse, I'm not a sucker. I don't pay those rewards, but they still get paid every time you swipe. Every time you swipe, a banker gets its wings or whatever, however that goes, right? So when you swipe, you are giving the bank money. Because they get a cut. They get a little cut. And there are a few people that there's a processor that gets a cut. There's a gateway that gets a cut. And there's a bank that gets a cut. And sometimes there's another bank that gets a cut, like the issuer and then the holder. There's weird words for it. But like, so many people have their fingers in this pie that's these transaction fees that we all pay, that the merchant pays on our behalf, that we all end up paying because the merchant's paying it, right? If you assume that you're in a fairly competitive market. So in that instance, we are paying it. So when someone says, well, I get 1% back, well, the bank got more than 1% for you swiping. So they're still totally okay with this. So that's one way to view it, is just like, oh, maybe that the banks are okay with this, not just okay, but that they love it. So that's one thing. The other thing you could do is say, well, who pays for all of these rewards if it's not me? Well, it's someone that's paying late fees and interest. And so you might approach it from an altruistic sense, which, honestly, to be totally frank, it doesn't like move me. I'm just not like, I'm going to do this because I don't want someone else to have to pay for my reward. It doesn't. But I know a lot of people that for whom that really is the moving factor. And they just say, you know, altruistically, I don't want someone else that's struggling to be paying my reward fees. Also an interesting view. There's a third view that I'm curious about for my year of experiment. And that is, we've always talked about how a credit card is handled in YNAB as if it's a debit card, as if it's just cash. So we kind of feel good about it. And so we're like, whenever you want something, you just will adjust the budget to make sure it happens. And if you're using a credit card or not, it's fine. But you're always kind of saying, I want something. I make the budget, allow me to have that thing done. My theory is that the credit card specifically might be upstream and be actually affecting our wants. And this is early for me, so I'm putting myself out there in this way, not fully formed thoughts. But if the use of a credit card actually affects your want center, like your dopamine hit center, and there's good research to say that it does, then it's actually affecting your wants, and then you're forcing your plan to adjust to this newly influenced want that came about because of credit card usage. So,
oh man, that's like another level deeper right there.
Yeah, and so I'm just curious about it. So I'll be back next year or whatever, and I'll let you guys know that I'm like filthy rich now because I don't use a credit card. You know that's not going to be the case, but I will say one other win is it's far simpler. It's just far simpler just to have one instrument that you use. Fraud protection on debit cards is as good as it's ever been. So that one really doesn't hold water anymore like it did you know, 15 years ago.
Well, you know, the points guy, if he was to talk to you, Jesse, he'd be like, I guess you just don't want that free trip to Tahiti, bro. Like, what's your problem?
You're talking to a guy that has literally millions of points because, because we spend in the business where we, you know, in business, you can't even have corporate spending without it being on some kind of a credit system. And so even if you try and avoid it, you almost can't. It's like built into all of your corporate spending. Employees have cards and things. So yeah, you're talking to a guy that has loads of points. And you know, does it make us spend more on the business? Man, I sure hope not, because those millions of miles are way more expensive than being able to spend less. The fact that the banks love it so much, that's, as my eighth grade daughter would say, that sounds a little sus. You know?
Yeah, no, it does. Yeah, I totally get where you're coming from. And I think it is an interesting thing to consider. And I think you make some good points. And it's worth thinking about whether or not we're being short-sighted in credit card usage.
Well put.
And I think a lot of people probably are. And but I want to know, too, about maybe your take on like a bigger debt question, like good debt versus bad debt. Some people would say, we've had, for instance, Michelle Singletary, who writes for The Washington Post, who we respect a ton, who's been writing about personal finance for decades, and she says there is no such thing as good debt. And then other people would say, oh my gosh, you have a mortgage at 2.5% and inflation's running hot at 7% right now. You better just hold on to that thing. That thing's good for you. Do you have a take on that?
Yeah, it's more of a personal take. I paid off my mortgage as fast as I could when we bought our first house. And then we sold that house and we bought a more expensive house. And I had a mortgage on that for a few years and I just wanted to pay it off as fast as I could. So then I was sitting mortgage free with the first one. Sorry, I kind of jumped ahead. And we bought a townhome as like a rental. And so I put 50% down. This was back when real estate didn't cost you like your firstborn. This is like 2012 or something like that. And so I got a mortgage on that, and it was kind of it was our only mortgage. And then I bought another townhome, and I ended up with four townhomes that were all over a period of years with very modest mortgages, totally cash flowing. At the end of the day, after we'd paid off our personal, or, you know, our second home that we had bought again, I still ended up just paying off those, even the real estate. So I just don't want to be stressed. And that's it's worth so much to me. And I do benefit from a business that's profitable. And so it's not like I'm trying to make real estate my livelihood, where I'm really like, I got to eke out real financial return from this. And so in that instance, I can be more hand wavy about the financial upside to leverage. But push comes to shove, as far as personal goes, I've never liked it. I feel like it messes with your decision making in a real way, and not in a good way. And so I like the idea of paying cash for stuff, saving up for things. And I just never seen anyone say, you know, gosh, I really wish I were in more debt. I just never hear anyone drop that line. So I guess I agree with your friend at the Washington Post. I don't really think that there's good debt. I think if a lot of people could own their home free and clear, they absolutely would, regardless of how crazy low, artificially low, like crazy low those interest rates are. Sure. I mean, that in and of itself is a financial chimera almost, how low they've been for, you know, it's like our age that, you know, I'm guessing we're all about the same age. We think it's normal to be at that rate, you know, 2, 3, 4. And there's nothing normal about that. It's just that it's all we've known for the last 20 years.
Right? Yeah, we're even talking about, I saw an article today, interest rates are so high and it's curbing the housing market. And it's like, they're not high historically. No. They're high compared to what we've experienced lately over the past, you know, few years. But they're not historically high. They're still pretty low.
Yeah, absolutely.
And we were talking about, you know, YNAB specifically, the software that you founded. How can folks learn more about YNAB? And I'm actually curious too, y'all specifically, you have a 34-day free trial. So A, where can folks learn about YNAB? And B, why is it a 34-day trial?
Yeah, so they can learn about it at YNAB.com and take classes, jump on YouTube, watch the videos. It's a really different way of thinking about money. So I would hope that they wouldn't just be like, oh, I used to use Quicken, so I'll just replace it. Like, it's different. And so you really want to make sure you see where the thinking is coming from and then look at how the tool integrates with that. As far as the 34-day trial, we want you to see how it works with a month rolling over. So no matter when you start, if with a 34-day trial, you'll always have a month plus a little to kind of see like, oh, I set aside money this month, that money is available next month, and they can start to see that rule two in action and things starting to, you know, cash starting to build up. It's liberating for people to see that. So yeah, 34-day trial all day long helps people kind of make that early connection on what it's going to be like to save up for stuff, you know, like save now, buy later instead of whatever we have. Right?
Oh gosh, let's make that a trend. Let's let that catch on.
Seriously. Yeah.
And it's always free for students too, right?
Yeah, we give a free year for students. So graduate student, high school student. And also we launched YNAB together. So if you're listening to this and you're like, oh man, this would be great for me, but also for like my teenage kid, you can buy, you know, you buy a subscription, it's $100 a year. So it's certainly reasonable. But then you can have, I think, up to five other people. And we intend for this to be like family, you know, close family. But you could put your kids on it. You don't have to pay an extra subscription fee, things like that. Once your kid flies the nest, which you hope happens, they get the free year and then they can go off on their way. So honestly, we really want the kids to be hooked on this. Like we want them just to think, oh yeah, this is how you do money. You save up for stuff, you evaluate your priorities, you spend guilt-free. We want to check all those boxes for these kids.
I love it. Jesse, thank you so much for joining us on the show today, man.
Thanks
we really appreciated
me.
It.
Yeah, I appreciate it.
All right. Well, Joel, what a great conversation, man. Talking about something that is a fundamental building block when it comes to your personal finances.
Yeah.
Talking with Jesse about budgeting, but specifically YNAB, the software that he pioneered, that he founded. What was your big takeaway from our conversation with him today?
Well, one, I feel like you love budgets more than you love me as your best friend. And so I feel like this was probably like your favorite episode of
everything,
all time.
Everything he said, I was just like, yes.
I can see you over there. You're just like, you're drooling a little bit as he talked.
It.
Yeah, you're really
it,
into
man.
It. So no, I really appreciate
Once he was diving into like the whole time, like the time, space, money continuum. Oh man, I was very much nerding out over here.
It's one of those things, I was going to say this. It's one of those things that it's hard for us to conceptualize, but software can help us actually understand how that's working and then make plans accordingly.
Sure.
But like our feeble human brains have a hard time with that. But the software actually really, I think, helps drive that home for people,
sure.
Which is something we need to wrap our minds around if we're going to, you know, save and invest effectively. But I think my big takeaway from this combo with Jesse,
nugget.
Yeah, he said, knowing that you'll run out of money helps crystallize your priorities. And the reality is that we're all going to run out of money at some point. Depends on how much money we're making and how fast it's going out. But knowing that it's going to run out is going to help you crystallize those priorities. And so what is it that is most important to you? It's all about trade-offs, right? And a lot of people look at our family and they're like, you guys are like, make enough money to afford two nice cars. What are you doing driving one old beat up junky minivan? And it's like, we just don't care. But knowing that it's going to run out helps us crystallize our priorities, and our priorities lie elsewhere. Someone on Twitter today said, what if you just got $1 million? What's one thing you would not upgrade? What's one thing you would not spend more money on? And I'm like, my car. I just don't care enough. And I would rather see that money go elsewhere.
You'd think about the Rivian, but you wouldn't pull the trigger.
Oh, I think about it. I'd lustfully look at pictures on the internet, but then after that, I would say no. And so I just think that's really important for you to know, because everybody has limits, right? And there's only so many yachts that Jeff Bezos can even buy. Well, that's probably a bad example. But like we all are going to run out at some point. And so let that crystallize in your mind the positive ways that you can use your budget to funnel money towards the areas that really matter.
Nice, man. I like that. Mine has to do with how it is you spend as well. He was basically at some point earlier, I don't know his exact words, but he said that essentially you shouldn't have any spending on your books that you feel guilty about. Mm. Essentially, everything that you spend money on, it should be something that you are maybe not necessarily excited about, but it shouldn't be something that you feel bad for doing. And that's because hopefully you have aligned how it is that you are spending your money with the ways that you want to spend your money. And so if there are ways that you don't want to spend your money, well, certainly it could have arisen from previous decisions that you made, maybe that were poor decisions. So if you're making like credit card payments or payments towards something that you have changed your mind on, well, that might be a case where things aren't aligned. But that's because you made a poor decision in the past about pushing those expenses into the future, as opposed to
which we've all done.
Yeah, absolutely. As opposed to pushing your money into the future. But I think if you do have something in your life that you are spending on every single month, And not only is it not providing you joy and it's not providing you value, but you feel like it's something that, like you have some sense of guilt associated with that. I would encourage folks out there to stop and to think, why is it that you feel that way? Because it might either be something super simple. It could be a practical reason that, oh, well, this is a category maybe that we shouldn't be spending this money in this way. And so not only is it, can it be fixed in a very practical way in that you just change how it is that you're spending, but maybe it could lead to you taking some time to self-reflect and to think, why is it that I don't feel great about how it is I'm spending my money in this way? I think it could potentially lead to change in both areas. But I like that you should not have any spending on your books that you feel guilty about.
I love, too, when he talked about the budget burn down, and it's this way to like completely reassess everything, because you might have just listened and you're like,
big old reset.
There's a bunch of stuff that I really want to do that I can't actually afford, but I got all these other old expenses laying around in my life. And if I could just cut a couple of those out, then maybe I could actually spend more money more freely on the things that I really actually care about. And so you might have three cars in your driveway and you're like, listen, budget burn down. I'm going to sell one of them and I'm going to rent the other one out on Turo.
What if we only had one?
Yeah.
Wait a minute.
Those are the kind of decisions.
What if we had no cars? Yeah.
But if you just, there is that sort of thing that happens to all of us, inertia bias. We've done something, we kind of keep it going in perpetuity, but the budget burn down allows you to reassess everything. And I think that can be helpful. You might not want to change a bunch of stuff, but you might want to change a lot this year. So it's worth thinking about. All right, Matt, let's get back to the beer that we had on this, this episode. This was Igneous IPA by Hutton and Smith. What were your thoughts on this one?
It's really good, man. This is a dry hopped IPA. These guys are out of Chattanooga, and yeah, it was tasty. It was dry hopped. Oftentimes you expect some of those, I don't know, I guess I saw dry hopped and I saw the color of the can and I was expecting like a New England like dry hop beer. But it definitely was kind of more in that traditional IPA vein.
Yes.
And it had some of those sharper notes that you get from a dry hop beer.
A little more piney, a little more bitter.
Yeah. But not like over the top with like that West Coast resin. It still had some sweetness. It still had a malty backbone to it as well. But I definitely enjoyed it. What were your thoughts on this one?
Similar. Basically, it tasted really like a classic IPA. And it reminded me of
solid
like
beer.
Some of those olds hearing about it. IPAs that are just classics, but they don't make them like that very much anymore. Like the tendency is toward the juicy haze bombs, and so this one it has that more, those like more piney traditional bitter characteristics.
Torpedo a little bit,
but not over the top either. So I liked it. I liked it. It's nice to have a change up in IPAs because we do drink so many of those
orange juice IPAs.
Yeah, big juicy ones. So it's fun to try something, you know, a little more old school.
But. Absolutely. All right. Well, we'll make sure to link to YNAB where you can learn more about You Need a Budget, their budgeting software. You can find that link up in our show notes at howtomoney.com. Joel, that's going to be it for this episode, buddy. Until next time.
Best friends out.
Best friends out.
It's brand new season 2. I'm Marissa Thalberg.
And I'm Stephen Wolf at Adam. And we're excited to be back having bigger, bolder, and always real conversations.
Straight from the C-suite front lines of marketing, media, and more.
We have great friends joining from people you may know, like Vilmer Valderrama and Bobby Burke.
And people you'll want to know. So grab a coffee or, hey, even an Aperol Spritz and come join us on America's number one podcast network, iHeart.
Listen to brand new on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and my podcast Climbing in Heels is back and better than ever. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. Climbing in Heels is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Parents, if you've ever experienced bedtime battles with the kids, I'm going to let you into a little secret. The Koala Moon podcast has revolutionized over 20 million bedtimes, with parents like you calling it life-changing and the perfect nighttime routine. With original kids' bedtime stories and cozy sleep meditations, every episode has been specially designed to make bedtimes a dream. Listen to Koala Moon on the iHeartRadio app, on Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.